Welcome to the Shift Extension Paramedic Podcast. This podcast is brought to you by our show sponsor, Explorer Risk Medical. Explorer offer unique CPD adventures for paramedics, nurses, and doctors. You can learn about altitude, dive, tropical, or remote medicine whilst exploring some of the most picturesque locations in the world. So if you want to take your CPD out of the classroom and on an adventure, head to their website, www.explorerriskmedical.org. Hey, Matt, how are you?
Hey, Nick, I am going well, my friend. How are you?
Mate, I am tip top. Hey, for all our listeners who are not familiar with Matt, he's going to be joining us on some more episodes to have some discussions about some clinical topics. Matt, what are we talking about today?
Mate, this is, I think the last episode we did, we called it something like, what would you do if? This one is going to be another what we can do if, which I think the whole episode is just a very thinly veiled disguise for me to get the chance to grill a senior CCP like yourself and find out what it is that I don't know, what it is I should be knowing in dealing with these patients. And today, mate, it's what would you do if you have a sick respiratory patient?
Fantastic. So for our listeners that missed our first episode on trauma, what would you do if? This is an opportunity for Matt, the inquisitive clinician that he is, to ask me whatever he likes, and I'll try and come up with an answer, because some of the best learning happens when you just have a bit of an informal chat at work about something you saw, something you're not quite sure about, or just challenging the norms of our profession. So we're going to record it. Matt's going to grill me. Hopefully I have some answers for you, but we'll see how we go. So,
you know, it's really like from my perspective as just a regular on road paramedic, if you don't know something, that of itself is good information for me, because that says, okay, this is probably something which isn't going to be a big deal for me on the day to day. So it's helpful in giving me a frame of reference as well. So even if you don't know, I still enjoy learning that.
How do you feel about respiratory patients? I get mixed bags. Like, some people don't mind respiratory patients. Some people are terrified of them. What's your position?
I find them really, really difficult, at least at this stage of my career. I've only been out for a few years, and in the area that I work, the demographics, I just see very, very few people who are genuinely sick respiratory patients.
Okay.
So in the last few years, I've seen 2 APO patients.
Yep.
And only a handful of patients who are sick with like I'm going to talk to you about today, like an exacerbation of COPD and pneumonia that's really at that severe end of life kind of stage.
Mm.
And every time I see it, it's hard because I just don't have that exposure, that frame of reference. It makes it quite stressful.
That's understandable. I think that's a common theme we hear. It's not like cardiac patients where you can do a point of care test to see how sick they are, aka an ECG, right? You know, you can have respiratory patients that are, you know, very hypoxic that are kind of okay, and ones with normal sats that are very, very sick. And there's all kinds of different conditions, and sometimes they can be co-associated with other conditions. And, you know, they're a bit of a mixed bag and usually comorbid. You know, kids get a lot of respiratory problems and they can cause quite serious illness. So it's quite a varied subset of our patients, and sometimes they can be quite complex.
And the other one I'll toss out is just auscultation specifically.
Mm.
I mean, I'm happy auscultating clear lungs. I'm good with that.
Mm.
And I think I'm okay at stridor specifically and at wheezes. But when we get into the other things, it starts getting very hard for me to tell them apart.
Okay.
That maybe, I don't know. So I'm using my mum's stethoscope from the 1970s. This is true, actually.
Sorry, what?
Yeah, I'm using my...
Your mother?
My mum has... Yeah, my mother was a physiotherapist and she gave me her stethoscope from like 1978 or something.
Yes, that is awesome.
I'm continuing to use it. Maybe I have a bad stethoscope, but I'm pretty sure I'm actually just pretty dodgy at auscultation.
Have you tried it with another stethoscope?
No. I have never tried another.
Or is that like a betrayal to the family?
Yeah, man, we're Italian. We take this stuff very seriously, you know. It's a stethoscope yeah. for life.
Yeah, it's like not finishing your food. You may as well say, I don't love exactly. you.
All right, mate. So the patient that I am going to imagine you're going to is
yes.
You get dispatched to an acute exacerbation of COPD. It's one of those residential aged care facilities. Caretakers have found the patient struggling to breathe.
Mm-hmm.
You get out there, and sure enough, you walk in and the person is sitting upright in a chair, leaning forward. They're doing that auto peep thing with the lips where they've kind of got those pursed lips to generate a bit of that peep to help them exhale.
Mm-hmm.
You can hear them like wheezing and making weird adventitious noises from across the room, and they've got a horrible cough every like couple of minutes that comes up. Their eyes are closed. They can talk to you in sentences.
Mm-hmm.
Nursing staff have them on a couple of liters a minute, and that's it. So that was what I went to. So my kind of thing was I looked at that patient and I went, okay, they fall into the sick category in my mind, in terms of that very binary initial quick snap judgment. And then I thought, oh, just sounds like an exacerbation of COPD. They were mildly febrile at like 37.7, but they've been on paracetamol for like 3 days. So I was suspecting some kind of a fever. The lung sounds were like just a nightmare because there was like just wheeze everywhere and then weird things on top of the wheeze because they have this mucousy lung. So I couldn't tell what's going on. So we just started them off down that kind of, you know, pneumonia, sepsis, COPD mixed bag pathway.
Sure, sure.
When you go to a patient like this, what are the kind of first things that you do on scene?
It's interesting you mentioned the, you know, being dispatched to a patient with COPD or an exacerbation of COPD. I think that's good to have that in the forefront of your differentials, but it's important not to walk into these jobs being biased. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes when patients have a chronic condition, any acute presentation can easily be siloed into being attributed to that chronic condition, okay? So, you know, they're 100%. Breathless, it must be a COPD. Patient,
you know, the nursing staff comes over and gives you their medical history and it's everything. It's just, there's so many conditions. There's a million medications that I've never heard of. You're spot on, mate.
So I think the first thing to consider is just to have an open mind about the possibilities here, all right? It could be an exacerbation of COPD, and this can be exacerbated by a number of things. We generally think like infection as the exacerbator of COPD, because remember, it's a chronic condition. They have irreversible lung damage that will not get better, okay? And it's a palliative condition in some patients as well, okay? And they have it every day. So I had an auntie, she had COPD, and she would be in a mild to moderate respiratory distress every day. Just walking to the kitchen to make a cup of tea, she would get very breathless to the point that she couldn't speak in a full sentence, okay? And this was her normal. This was her daily thing. So for her to have an exacerbation, there's got to be something driving that. There's got to be a stressor. And a lot of the time it is infection, but other things can do it as well. So some patients, there's a cohort of COPD patients that have exacerbations due to an allergic exposure. So they get really sick really quickly. Similar to, you see this in some asthma patients now. So you get the one cohort of asthma patients that like, I've been sick for 3 or 4 days with a cough and a fever and I'm just getting worse and now I'm tired and I've called you because nothing else is helping. And there's another cohort who are perfectly fine. And then 30 minutes later, they're really, really sick because they have almost this heightened allergic immune response, almost like anaphylaxis, but just the respiratory aspect of it. So it's quick, it's rapid onset, and they get sick really, really quickly. There's a cohort of COPD patients that can have their exacerbation from an acute allergy style presentation. And that's where your history comes in, right? That's where, and you know what? They'll get better with adrenaline, right? Rather than nebs. And we'll talk about that later. And then there's the COPD patients or the patients who have COPD that have acute heart failure, okay? Because a lot of the time, if they've got COPD from a poor lifestyle choice, they're more likely to have comorbid disease such as cardiovascular disease. So the two can often be associated together or found together in patients. But it can be other things. It can be pneumonia. It can be a pleural effusion. It could be a pericarditis. It could be a DKA. It could be a sepsis and from another source, and they're just got a metabolic acidosis and their CO2 is a bit high, so they're breathing faster. Could be lots of things. So it's really important. Take the information you have, but don't anchor on that information too soon.
That was a really neat little list you just rattled off there. I'm going to have to go back and listen to this and write that down later on because I should have written it down just then, but I missed my chance. So what I did with this lady was I started her off. So you could hear her breathing. She's coughing. She's talking. Mm. So in that case, I'm not giving adrenaline. For me, it's only indicated in my protocols for like a silent chest.
Mm.
For you, at what stage would you consider adrenaline for a respiratory patient? Is all the way at the point when you can't hear any air movement at all? Or would you ever give it a little bit earlier when you can see them trending downhill?
So here's my thing about adrenaline, right? If you go and look at respiratory guidelines from hospitals and other advisory groups around how to manage acute severe exacerbations of asthma and COPD, you'll actually not see adrenaline mentioned. Adrenaline seems to be a pre-hospital thing. And I think we brought it in there maybe years ago when we didn't have other tools in our toolkit to manage these patients, or theoretically we think it works. From my understanding, there's not a lot of research out there that looks at like adrenaline versus placebo in these cohort of patients. It's kind of just been put in there for this group of six sick patients, but it's not really supported elsewhere. So,
mate, that is so interesting.
Yeah. And it makes sense. Amazing. It makes sense from a pharmacological perspective, right? It acts on your beta-2 receptors causing bronchodilation. Awesome. Great for patients that maybe aren't breathing effectively enough to move air down into their lungs, aka move, say, a nebulized medication down into their lungs to have an effect, right? So we go for intravenous or intramuscular medications instead. Great for your asthma patient who has reversible lung disease, who's young and healthy, who has a reversible pathology, gives them adrenaline, they get better. But they're young enough that they can handle the side effects, right? Mm. Versus my old COPD patient that has irreversible lung damage that may not be able to handle the side effects of the medication. The challenge for the clinician is trying to determine how deviated your patient is from their baseline. So it's easier in an asthmatic. Let's say you have asthma, right? Your baseline is you are right now. You're talking in full sentences. You have no respiratory distress whatsoever, right? So if I go to you and your ALOC, you're speaking in single words, you're hypoxic, I know how deviated you are from your baseline. In COPD patients, it can be really difficult. And I go back to that example of my auntie. Her baseline's quite augmented from, say, the normal person, right? So if she calls an ambulance or sees a nurse or a doctor and she's speaking in short phrases with a moderate respiratory distress, she might only be mildly deviated away from her baseline. So sometimes the challenge is trying to determine how deviated from that patient's baseline they are, and whether medications like adrenaline are really going to be effective for those patients. Because the other thing is, patients who get sick over a long period of time are going to take a long period of time to get better. Patients who get sick quickly can turn a corner quickly. So you might go to these COPD patients who are sick and they've been sick for a week. They've been working hard for a week. Throwing some adrenaline in their arm isn't going to do anything. All right, but I think sometimes we go to it because we think it works and that's all we have.
Really interesting. And when you said earlier on that they potentially can't deal with the side effects, what you'd mean there is blood pressure going up, heart rate going up, and all of that increasing the workload of their heart, whereas they don't really necessarily have any perfusion problems. They just have the respiratory problems. Is that what you meant?
Yeah, essentially. And I'm not saying that don't give COPD patients adrenaline. I think what I'm saying, where I'm getting with that is be cautious, take a moment, do a thorough assessment, try and determine where your patient is in regards to their own baseline, and then look at other alternatives as well. Okay, so your thresholds change based on your patient cohort.
That's great. Fantastic. And that's because what I would do for this patient is give them the salbutamol, the ipratropium bromide, just for a nebulizer, and we then gave them some hydrocortisone, load them up in the back of the truck. We're about an hour from hospital and we take off. And at that stage, patient's starting to look a little bit better. Now, I have a very random question for you here about nebulizers.
Oh, okay.
Actually, I've got a few random questions. I'll toss them out one at a time.
Yeah, go. Okay.
Nebulizers.
Yes.
Way back when I was at uni, I was taught that nebulizers need a minimum amount of liquid. I can't remember how many mils, but I was taught if you only put in like 1 mil or something, it doesn't work. It doesn't generate the aerosols. I cannot find, like, I had a quick Google and I can't see anything there. It's certainly not in my guidelines. Have you ever heard anything about that? Do you have any idea?
No. Okay. No,
cool.
Not at all. Must be one of those things that just gets around the circles. No, I haven't heard anything.
Urban legend,
urban legend. I think it would work quite effectively because, like, a pediatric nebulizer, or I think all presentations of salbutamol, let's use that as an example drug, are 2.5 mils. So it's a very small amount of liquid, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that'll last a fair bit of time.
Mm-hmm.
No, unusual.
Now, let me ask you too, this is not for this patient specifically, but just generally speaking. So in my unit, we carry nasal cannulas, simple face masks or nebulizers. We've got the non-rebreather mask and we've got the BVM. Now, in my entire working time as a paramedic over the last few years, I have only ever used nasal cannulas or a nebulizer or a BVM. Mm. I've never used the simple face mask or the non-rebreather. And I don't know if I'm just, you know, not picking up on the patients they're appropriate for, or if they're just in a really niche cohort that I haven't come across. Are you using those very often, and what kind of patients are you using those particular masks on?
To be honest, no, not really. I think Hudson masks, they're kind of this middle ground, and I guess you could use them theoretically if you had a patient with an oxygen demand. I usually like to start high and work my way down. So pop them on a non-rebreather mask that we know is going to give the highest concentration of oxygen out of all of the masks. And then work your way down. Once you've done everything else, work your way down until you titrate their oxygen to greater than 94% or thereabouts. So we don't use a lot of Hudson masks. Non-rebreathers, you know, if I had to think of the cohort of patients that I use them the most, probably be the ROSC patient who's breathing independently of themselves, or the sick trauma patient who might be, you know, unconscious or have a significant chest injury and a significant oxygen demand. But apart from that, they don't get used much anymore. And I think we're being much more mature about how we deliver oxygen compared to, say, 20 or 30 years ago, which was everyone got oxygen. When I started, every single chest pain got 15 liters on a non-rebreather every single time. It was called...
I didn't realize you were that old.
Oh, I'm pretty... Oh, thank you. I think it was called Moan, Morphine, Oxygen, Aspirin, and Nitrates was the mnemonic.
Yeah. Mona was the one.
Mona,
warned about. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So it just was. So we just don't give out as much oxygen as we used to.
Yeah, one of my old uni lecturers said that when he started, his treatment was Bob, bed, oxygen, blanket.
Fantastic.
Every person just got those three things.
Yes. Excellent.
Fantastic. Now, let me ask you about high-flow nasal cannulas, because this is something which I just continually see people talking about, mostly in the context of pre-oxygenation for like for an RSI or a delayed sequence intubation, which is not something I do. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of something I'm vaguely aware of but isn't really involved in my actual treating of patients on the day-to-day. Now, I have a set of nasal cannulas. Can I just crank those up to 15 liters a minute, or do I need special nasal cannulas to do that?
That's a good question. I think you can put high-flow nasal cannulas into two groups. And the first group is the one you just mentioned, which is being utilized as a pre-oxygenation tool. And essentially, in the setting of, say, rapid sequence intubation. All right, so that's where we put your standard, normal nasal prongs on, we crank them to 15 liters per minute, and the idea is that we fill the lungs up, we get rid of all the nitrogen, fill the lungs up with oxygen, but also what that does is it prolongs our time to desaturation, all right? So it prolongs the time it takes until
that patient... window to get the tube in and secure
correct,
the patient.
Correct, because the idea is that we're going to give some medicines to make the patient unconscious and then paralyze them and they'll stop breathing. So if we force someone to stop breathing, eventually they're going to become hypoxic, right? And we want to delay that for as long as possible while we secure their airway and then start breathing for them again. So they found that oxygen via nasal prongs does that really well. So that's kind of that first group of high flow nasal prong oxygenation. Now, the other one is probably something you see in hospital more so than the pre-hospital setting, specifically through Australia. I'm not quite sure if they're doing this overseas. Now, this is high flow nasal oxygen therapy used as like a non-invasive oxygenation or no, non-invasive ventilation for patients with certain respiratory presentations. And it essentially looks like a fancy nasal prong, but it can go up to quite high flow rates. So we're talking 40 to 60 liters per minute. So if you had a patient that you wanted to do high flow nasal oxygenation on because you wanted to make a poor man's CPAP, our oxygen regulators physically won't give you enough flow. So let's say I did have that device and I was putting that on a patient at 60 liters per minute, that would equate to about 5 to 7 centimeters of water through a standard CPAP mask. Okay. So it doesn't really give you, it gives you enough to get by, but not heaps and heaps and heaps. Right. And it's great. It's great for kids that you can put in their nose. They can still feed. It's not as distressing. They'll tolerate it more. It's good for adults that don't quite need a big mask on their face, but they still need a bit of that support. So it does have value in it, but you won't be doing it in an ambulance anytime soon.
Brilliant. Fantastic, mate. That's really good to know. Love it. And you mentioned a moment ago CPAP, which is great because that's the next topic I want to move on to. Yeah.
Fantastic.
So we have our patient, we're driving out of hospital, and when you get to hospital, the patient's really, really quite crook, quite bad.
Yep.
And at that stage, you take them into the ED, and the ED, to my surprise, start them on CPAP. This was for a COPD patient. And within my specific indications, as a regular paramedic, I'm only indicated to give CPAP for an APO. And when I was an undergrad at uni, I was taught that the purpose of that is to increase the pressure and push the fluid out of the alveoli back into the interstitial space and create some more room. What I've learned since then is that there's at least another couple of benefits to it. One is splinting open the airways to prevent that dynamic airway collapse where the pressure around the airways collapses them and the patient can't exhale.
Yep.
And the other one is for some diseases like a pneumonia or something like that, the alveoli where they've lost all that surfactant and they're getting that atelectasis, it can help hold them open. And that's referred to as recruiting more alveoli. Now, is that right? Is that wrong? Am I missing stuff? What are your thoughts?
It's great. It's fantastic. You're on the money. And you mentioned CPAP, so continuous positive airway pressure, not to be confused with BiPAP, which is biphasic airway pressure support. Right. So these two, BiPAP and CPAP, fall under the kind of umbrella term of non-invasive ventilation. So it's a way to ventilate someone without being invasive, aka intubating them, putting them to sleep, and putting them on a ventilator. So the main difference is CPAP gives you the same continuous pressure through the inspiratory cycle and the expiratory part of the cycle. And then BiPAP can give you two different pressures. All right. So you can change the pressure you give during inspiration compared to the pressure you give during expiration. Now, this is relevant when we start talking about patients with bronchospasm. When we have bronchospasm, the main issues is that we can't get air out. But we also have a degree of atelectasis because we get this mucus that plugs the end of the alveoli and then we can't get air into them to get good effective gas exchange. But because we also have this bronchospasm and we can't get the air out, we have gas trapping. So we have high intrathoracic pressures within our lungs. Now, the problem with this is in order for us to normally inspire, we have to overcome the pressure within our lungs for air to travel from the outside environment down into our lungs. And this is called negative pressure ventilation, which is normal breathing that you and I are doing right now. So our diaphragm descends and air gets sucked in down a path. But if I've gas trapped, I have to work harder to overcome that gradient. And that's where you start having to use all your accessory muscles.
In there. Correct. So you're going to have to pull a little bit harder to reduce the pressure that little bit more, et cetera, et cetera.
Correct. And that's where we get all that respiratory distress from. So what BiPAP does is it provides inspiratory pressure that helps you get that air in. I like to think of it as if you are running up a hill and the hill's quite steep and you're starting to get pretty tired and Matt comes along and goes around the back of you and pushes you up. Right, so you can keep running up under your own steam.
What's going to happen, mate?
Come on, you can do it.
You're me run, but, mate. It's not a pretty sight.
Oh, you could run. So you're still running for yourself.
Run to the fridge.
Matt hasn't taken over. He hasn't put you in a wheelchair and started to push you. You're still doing it for yourself, but he's just giving you a bit of a hand. Okay, so that's the inspiratory portion of the BiPAP. The expiratory portion is about giving a little bit of resistance on the exhalation, and what this does is it splints open those alveoli that have collapsed and allows for effective gas exchange. So in the setting of bronchospasm, it opens them to get past that mucus plug to allow for gas exchange. In the setting of pulmonary edema, where we've had our surfactant wash out and that atelectasis occur where our alveoli have collapsed, splints them open again and we get a good effective gas exchange. Now in, say, APO, where we don't have bronchospasm, where we can get air in and out quite easily, we can essentially get away with having the same pressure on inspiration as expiration, right? So we have 5 centimeters of water for inspiration and 5 centimeters of water for expiration. And then if we want to up it, we can do that. So go to 10 and 10 or 15 to 15. Whereas if I have asthma and I put them on CPAP, if I want to increase their inspiratory pressure, I also have to increase their expiratory pressure. And that can be counterintuitive, right? If I increase their expiratory pressure really high, they're not going to be able to get gas out because they're having trouble getting it out already. You're going to make the problem worse. So you want to have 2 different levels. So if you had APO and I put you on CPAP, I might put you on 10 and 10. So 10 centimeters of inspiratory pressure versus 10 centimeters of expiratory pressure. Versus if you had asthma, I might start you off on 14 and 3, right? So there can be vast differences between the pressures that you use dependent on the pathology that's in front of you.
So the BiPAP machine, how does that know when to swap pressures? Does that somehow sense when a person is breathing in and breathing out?
Correct.
Amazing.
Yeah, they're pretty
incredible
cool.
Piece of technology.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we don't have them pre-hospital yet.
Mm.
And I think the technology exists, just whether or not there is a case for it.
They definitely do in some spots. They definitely do in some spots pre-hospital. Mm. But yeah, I suppose it all comes down to things like value for money and
how much
benefit it is and all that kind of thing. So
yeah, definitely.
It's quite complex. Mate, that was a really neat little explanation. Now, I wanted to check as well, because what I was taught back in the day was that CPAP, and I'm assuming BiPAP as well,
mm-hmm.
are good for APO and good for COPD. They are maybe good for asthma and maybe good for pneumonia. And what you do is trial them and then see how the patient goes. Is that also your understanding? When are you using those?
Well, the evidence for BiPAP is the strongest in the setting of COPD patients, right? The evidence suggests that they do better with BiPAP versus no BiPAP. They have reduced ICU admissions, reduced rates of intubation, reduced hospital length, reduced mortality. They can make decisions for themselves. They can eat and drink. It's just good. The evidence for asthma, I haven't looked at it recently. I don't think there's a lot of evidence, but it makes sense because the pathophysiology of asthma has some common characteristics with, say, COPD. Surrounding the bronchospasm and the mucus plugging in the inflammation. And APO is the same. The evidence for CPAP and APO seems to be more broadly around non-invasive ventilation rather than CPAP specifically. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's because most hospitals just use BiPAP now, right? Because they can nuance it based on what the patient needs.
And I'm assuming if you want your BiPAP to be a CPAP, you can do that. You just set the settings to be the same.
Correct. Mm. That's it.
Now, can I ask you about something I saw once?
Yeah, go on.
Which I thought was really fascinating, which was inside a hospital, they had a patient on the CPAP mask, and then underneath it, they had nasal cannulas going in.
Oh.
And the CPAP mask was giving, you know, whatever. I'm not really sure, actually. I don't know the settings, but we'll imagine something like, you know, 12 litres a minute to generate that 10 centimetres of water.
Was this a disposable? Was this a disposable CPAP mask?
It was, weirdly.
Like similar to one an ambulance service would use?
It was one that an ambulance service would use, yeah. And then underneath it, they had the nasal cannulas, which were giving a little bit of extra O2.
Okay.
And I asked someone there, I'm not sure if they were a doctor or a nurse or maybe just a family member. I have no idea who I was talking to. But I asked them why they were doing that. And they said, well, look, this particular person, their respiratory rate's through the roof. The tidal volume's normal, so they're trying to suck in like 40 litres a minute, and the CPAP's only giving them, you know, whatever it's cranked up to. So by giving them the nasal cannulas, we can make out the difference. Sorry, I said 40. I mean, the respiratory rate was like 40. They were trying to suck in like 20 litres a minute or something like
that. Yeah, sure.
And if your CPAP mask's only giving them 12, they can turn up the nasal cannulas and give them the extra 8 and this kind of thing. Look, I've never seen it before. I have no idea what to make of it. What are your thoughts on that? Is that something you've seen? Is that something which you're doing? Is that something which is ridiculous? What's your experience?
Look, I can see the logic in what they're saying, but if you understand how the device works, you understand that there's safety built into it, all right? And it's the same with any oxygen mask, and it's the same with any bag valve mask. So any oxygen device has a safety redundancy built into it, which means that if the patient's tidal volume or minute volume is beyond the supply of the device, then they're not going to suffocate. What they do
is an inlet valve. It'll get room air. It'll just drop their fraction bins by O2.
Correct. Right. All have inlet valves to the outside world that allows air to come in. It'll just change the FiO2 of what they're inhaling. Okay.
So the only benefit to this potentially would be to keep that FiO2 that little bit higher.
Correct.
But, you know, the other thing, and again, I didn't look, it wasn't something that I thought of at the time, but if there was a break in the seal of the CPAP, you would be losing all that positive pressure, or a lot of it anyway, and that would kind of render the whole thing redundant too. So you'd need to make sure that the little nasal cannula bits going in the side don't break the seal, I guess.
Correct. And that's the challenge with it, is that CPAP and BiPAP are really reliant on having a good seal to create that pressure. If you don't have a good seal, it's not going to be as effective. So I can see where they're coming from. And because a lot of the disposable CPAP devices are oxygen driven, then if you want to give them more oxygen but keep the same pressure, you can't do so, right?
Mm.
Whereas the ones you find in hospitals, you can actually adjust the amount of oxygen that's in the total system. So you can adjust the FiO2 of what's being delivered as well. So you can run them on just air if you want them to, or you can run them all the way up to 100% oxygen.
I want to ask you about BVMing.
Yes.
So BVMing is something which I'm doing quite rarely. Fortunately, most of my patients are able to breathe.
Mm-hmm.
So if I have three questions about the BVM. The first one was, it's just such an incredibly fundamental thing. It's crazy, I feel like, the need to ask this, but how much to actually squeeze? And what I was taught in university was, oh, well, the average patient needs 7 milliliters per kilogram. So you calculate their body weight, or, you know, guesstimate their body weight, which I've no doubt I'm doing incorrectly, by the by. Then you calculate what 7 mils is. Then you remember your BVM is 1.5 liters. So you try and calculate what percentage you should be squeezing it. That to me just seems like a system that's probably not going to be particularly accurate. What do you do are you doing a whole bunch of quick maths? what's going on in your head?
I'll be honest, I don't do that. And I think there's not much value in doing that, because you can sit there. Well, firstly, how good are you at predicting someone's body weight? Not very good.
Absolutely.
I don't think so.
Horrific.
All right. So
no way I'm good at that.
There's the first problem. Secondly, how good are you at maths on the fly? Yeah, okay, you can get it right. If you get your calculator out, sure, you can get that part right. Thirdly, how accurate do you think you are at correlating the desired squeeze the desired tidal volume with the actual squeeze that you're doing. So if that's you say, incredible. There's 70 kilos and I want to give 7 to 10 mils per kilo, that's called, 7 mils per kilo. So I want to give
500 mils.
500 mils, right?
So are about a third of a bag.
And how good are you?
A third?
How good are you at determining a third, right?
The only thing that I really like about this is it forces me. I do think that I'm liable to fall into the trap when I'm in a high acuity situation. I'm trying to BBM someone. There's so much going on. It's really stressful that I might be overzealous. I might squeeze too fast. I might squeeze too hard. And I like that this at least brings my attention to it and forces me to give it a bit of thought. There's no way I'm accurately squeezing a particular amount in. I wouldn't have a clue how much I'm squeezing in.
I think the advice I would give is twofold. One, don't worry about all that. Two, just be gentle, all right? Actually, threefold. And three, delegate that task out to someone that can be completely focused on that task. Years ago, they taught us that the team leader or the patient care officer or whatever you want to call it was at the head on the airway. And I disagree with that. I think that is a task that's difficult. It's not a basic skill. An airway or ventilating someone is not a basic skill. It's a fundamental skill. It's actually quite difficult. And I would say it's probably the most difficult skill we have, right? So it needs to be something that we're focused on. And there needs to be, if possible, a degree of task fixation on that, all right? So delegate it out. Let someone else do it and focus on it and do it well. And then have the team leader be in a hands-off position.
Absolutely awesome. Love it. Fantastic. The second question I wanted to ask you about the BVM is, how do I tell if I've got someone who's unconscious and they're slowly regaining consciousness?
Yes.
And they're starting to self-ventilate adequately. How do I tell that? How do I know if they're breathing in? How do you actually know when to stop BVMing?
Well, there's two things you can do. Well, there's three things. One, you can look at the patient's chest going up and down. This is easier in a static position, but very, very difficult to do in the back of a moving vehicle, all right? Mm. I struggle to do this even now, to look at the quality of someone's chest wall movement in the back of a moving vehicle. Hence why they invented...
Once or twice tried to take a respiratory rate that way. And it's just fraught with danger. Anyway, sorry about
that. Have you read the papers on the accuracy of respiratory rate?
I have not.
There was a paper. I have not. I'll have to find it. I'll put it in the show notes.
It's not good.
Oh, terrible. Terrible. They took a bunch of medical students and they taught them how to take respiratory rates. And they all walked into a nice, simple ward room and said, take this patient's respiratory rate over 30 seconds or 60 seconds. And even with that being the only task, they had nothing else to think about in a nice, cool, controlled environment of a ward. It was... There's horrendous mistakes made, right? So the crux of the story is we are terrible at taking respiratory rates, right? And how many people sit there for 30 seconds or a minute?
Mate, I got better things to do. No, I'm joking. I'm probably the only person I know who attempts to take respiratory rates.
Yeah.
I don't think I'm doing it well.
You know who you are, right? Everyone's written 18. Please take a respiratory rate as best as you can. But that's why they invented this beautiful tool called end-tidal capnography, right? So end-tidal capnography measures the amount of CO2 or carbon dioxide at the end of expiration using a device either within the nose, like a nasal cannula, or within a bag valve mask circuit. So it usually sits between the mask and, say, the bag valve mask filter. So it gives you a number, which is the end-tidal CO2 or carbon dioxide number, but it also shows a waveform. And what that waveform represents is expiration. So you can use it to monitor someone's ventilation or breathing, right? So the taller the waveform, the better the expiration. So generally, the better expiration, the better inspiration. So if you have someone with nice, tall, consistent peaks, that's telling you someone's probably breathing really well for themselves. And when they stop breathing, because they stop breathing or their airway's obstructed, that will go away. The great thing about end-tidal is that it happens and changes in real time. So you'll see that change in your patient long before they desat, long before their heart rate changes. So it's the best tool to monitor for real-time early deterioration and also improvement. So it's a great tool for recognizing ROSC. So you'll see a big spike in their end-tidal CO2. Recognizing rearrest, their CO2 will dive because they no longer have flow around the body. But also determining quality of respiratory or ventilatory drive as well. Great, great piece of kit. So that's what I would use. If you want to take it a little bit further, if you didn't have that tool, on the top of your bag valve mask, there's a little thing called a duckbill valve, right? And whenever your patient inhales, this valve will open, which allows for the one-way flow of oxygen from the reservoir bag through the bag that you squeeze down through the mask to the patient, all right? So it means that when the patient exhales, they're not putting their exhaled air back into the system and diluting down the air mixture that's being delivered, right? So if a patient starts to breathe for themselves, you'll actually see this valve opening and closing with every breath.
Fantastic. So the three methods there are attempt to look at the chest wall, probably not going to work very well. Attach end tidal, probably the best method based on what you're saying so far.
Yep.
Or you could even just look for a little flutter of this duckbill in the actual tubing system, which is going to show the movement of air.
Correct.
Fantastic, mate. And then the last question I had, which was, again, not something I've ever done, just something I heard a story about once.
Yes.
Was a patient had, they'd choked on something. It had gone down past the glottis, so really far down into the trachea. And they couldn't remove the obstruction, the paramedics. So, and the person was, you know, losing consciousness, et cetera, et cetera. So what they actually did was cover that little valve on the BVM, the safety valve, which stops you pushing the pressor too high. Hmm. And then they just slammed the BVM as hard as they could. And they tried to blow the object down into the right bronchus so that they could ventilate the smaller left lung and have some air entry. Have you ever heard of that before? Is that like another urban legend that's just been that they're foisting onto university students, or is that something?
Oh,
I mean,
look,
it seems so risky and so crazy, but at the same time, you know,
it does seem quite wild. And you think about it, if you had a patient with an obstruction that's obviously past the vocal cords, so it's past or beyond what you can visualize or retrieve with, say, a laryngoscope and a McGill's forceps, right? So it's down past that point. So it's probably sitting in the trachea before the carina and the bifurcation to the lungs, causing that full obstruction, right? It's a really bad place to have an obstruction. So what do? You get your pushy-pushy device, aka your bag valve mask, and you ventilate them to push it down. But my thought is that if you are having to block that blow-off valve, and essentially what that does is it stops you from over-pressurizing or over-ventilating lungs that are stiff or over-inflated. So it puts essentially a ceiling on the amount of pressure you can deliver to the patient to prevent barotrauma. So if you have an obstruction and air is flowing down there, it's probably going to cause an increase in that pressure, and then the blow-off valve will go off and you won't be able to push any air down into the trachea. So it makes sense that you would close that to force it down. But the problem's going to be is that air is going to go down the path of least resistance. So it might go down a little bit into the trachea, but then it's also just going to go down to the stomach and you're just going to be insufflating the stomach.
Doing that. Yeah,
so it might work,
splinting.
But then you also might just be insufflating the stomach. But then again, your patient's dying. So your choices are pretty limited at that point. Would I do it routinely? Probably not. Would I consider it in, I've tried everything else and I have nothing else to try? Sure. What might dislodge it is the compressions you do once the patient goes into cardiac arrest. That could be helpful as well. But I think in that situation, yeah, no, it's plausible, but I wouldn't be, it wouldn't be the first tool I go for in my toolkit.
Fantastic. Absolutely love it, mate. And the very last question I wanted to ask you was that green thing that gets attached, which is some kind of a filter thingy-majiggy.
Oh, yes.
Can you tell me about that?
Oh, the green filter that sits between.
Yeah, so because it's just something which is there, which gets slapped into the circuit, which I assume is for some kind of antimicrobial purpose. I've never properly been taught about it. Don't know anything about it. What do you know?
Oh, wow. That's a great question. So what you're talking about is a little green filter that sits within the bag valve mask system. So it's generally somewhere between the bag valve and the mask. And it's like this little cheap thing that just goes there and you just put it on because that's what you've done since first year and you don't know any better. And it does filtration, I think. And they cost about 50 cents, right? But they're actually really, really important pieces of kit. And the reason they're important is they do things that the body normally does that it can't do when we, say, place it down in an LMA or we ventilate a patient. And those three things are humidification, warming, and filtration, right? So our body's really good at warming air, humidifying air, and filtering air before it gets to the lungs for gas exchange. And we find warm and humid air is best for gas exchange versus cold and dry air, right? Most of that filtration and some of that warming and humidification is done by the upper airways. So the nose, the nasopharynx, the oropharynx, and down through the trachea. That's kind of where all that stuff happens. So if we go and say intubate a patient and we bypass all of that space, we lose that ability to filter the air. We lose that ability to humidify it and warm it. And now we're pushing into our patients cold, dry, and particle-ridden air, which isn't great long-term for gas exchange. So what we do is we put a filter there so we can filter the air of particles before we push it down into the lungs. Now, the filters that we have just do filtration, right? But you can get filters that also do a degree of humidification. And what you'll find on like high flow nasal oxygenation systems and ventilators that they do both humidification and warming as well. So they essentially replace those three objectives that aren't being that aren't occurring because we bypass those upper parts of the airway.
Absolutely phenomenal, mate. I think you've done it all.
Is that it?
That was a long list of rambling questions, and I think you've smashed all of them. Absolutely amazing.
No worries, mate. Great questions. I really enjoyed it. What should we do next time?
Your time. I have an unusual one for you next time. It'll be a lot shorter.
Okay.
I think.
Yeah,
but it's going to be a hypothetical traumatic cardiac arrest.
Oh, sounds good. I'm looking forward to it, mate. For our listeners out there, if you have any questions for me or our team or for Matt, please write to us. You can find us on Facebook, on Instagram, or on our website, www.theshiftextension.org. But until next time, see you later.